This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
This week in our 271st episode, we have a brand new Spinosaurid in the news.
Ooh.
I think it's pretty exciting. We also have an interview with Matt Wadle and Brian Eng about an awesome new massive Brachiosaurus bone that they found in Utah, and also some corresponding paleo art. And we have our dinosaur of the day, Juravenator. But before we get into all of that, we'd like to thank some of our patrons who keep our podcast running. And this week, we'd like to thank Kyle, Brendan Kavanov, the Tolbert family, Remy Rodriguez, Rohan, Bradley, Bilal, Avery, Albertosaurus, Trev, Ayrton and Everett, Greg, and Jared Copeland.
Yeah, thank you so much, everybody. This community is great. And if you want to join it, then we have a lively Discord server going and other rewards that you can be a part of if you join at patreon.com/inodino.
So jumping into the news, I think we've covered every dinosaur that was found in 2019 now, but let us know if you found one that we missed, because there's no one place where they're all listed. The next closest thing is probably Wikipedia or maybe our show, but yeah. So if we miss something, let us know, because we want to cover every dinosaur that comes out. But on to 2020, we have a new Spinosaurid that was discovered, and this one was published in Cretaceous Research by Elizabeth Malafaya, I think, and others. And it is the most complete Spinosaurid ever found on the Iberian Peninsula, which for our purposes basically means Spain and Portugal, because those are the only parts of the Iberian Peninsula that have major dinosaur discoveries. But this one is named Valle Bonaventrix cani, and Valle Bonaventrix is after the nearby town of Valle Bona, and then Venetrix, which is Latin for huntress, they say. On the Discord server, we were just talking about female-named dinosaurs, so this one would definitely count.
Oh yeah, because Venator is hunter.
Yep. The ix part makes it feminine. And that's good too, because Valle Bona, obviously ending in an A in Spanish, must be a feminine named town, at least because these languages have genders, not like English. And then Cani is after Juan Cano Forner, I think, who found the fossils in the 1980s or early 90s. And specifically, he found them near Morea, Spain, which is on the east coast of Spain. A team actually went back there in 2018 to try to find some more remains, but they only found a, quote, small number of vertebrate remains of low taxonomic interest, end quote. So nothing exciting, I guess. Definitely no dinosaurs. Those are of high taxonomic interest.
Depends who you ask.
Yes, but I think so. So Juan, back in the 1980s or 90s, they didn't say specifically when this one was found several ribs, several partial hip bones, and most importantly, quite a few vertebrae, including a neural spine, from Valle Bonaventrix. That name is not easy to say. Part of its distinguishing feature set is that the neural spines are, quote, moderate height, end quote, when compared with the height of the centrum, which is the disc part of the vertebrae. So it kind of makes sense that you want that ratio of how tall the spine is compared to the size of the vertebrae. This means that it probably didn't have a massive sail, and the one neural spine that they have really, to me, looks a little bit more like a stegosaurus plate than it does what you'd think of with a Spinosaurus spine, because it's not tall and skinny. It's almost like as wide as it is tall. Apparently, though, it's only a small piece of what the entire total spine would have been, and so really, in life, it was likely much taller, but we don't know how much taller because it's broken off. So who knows? Maybe it had a really big sail, or maybe it was just a little bit above where it broke off. As it is, it was about very roughly 17 centimeters or about half a foot tall. And the base of it is almost, like I said, as wide as it is tall. It's a medium-sized spinosaurid, as they put it. And they didn't give any size estimates, probably because they're missing key bones. They don't have a femur. They don't have a skull, any of the really important bones that can sometimes help you figure out the size of an animal. But they do have a complete sacrum, which is those series of vertebrae that go in between the hips. And when you add those up, it's roughly 60 centimeters or about 2 feet long. So it kind of gives you a rough idea of how big the animal is. If it's just 2 feet for the hip part, you're talking about a pretty big dinosaur, not as big as Spinosaurus, but on the larger size of dinosaurs, I would say. Maybe 20 feet long, 30 feet long, somewhere in that ballpark.
Medium-sized for a spinosaurid.
Exactly. Vai Bonaventrix is from the early Cretaceous, roughly 125 million years ago. And because spinosaurids can be split into Spinosaurinae and Baryonychinae, we had to figure out where this one's fit. And they decided that Vai Bonaventrix is a Spinosaurinae member, not a Baryonychinae member, which means it's a closer relative to Spinosaurus than Baryonyx, which might mean something good for its sail proportions, because Spinosaurus obviously has a much bigger sail than Baryonyx. And it's especially interesting because Baryonyx was actually in Europe at the same time as Vai Bonaventrix, while Spinosaurus was quite a bit later, like 10 million years later, and it was in Africa, which means that potentially this dinosaur was more closely related to the African dinosaurs than it was to European dinosaurs, even though they might have been closer in time. It's previously been proposed that at the time, it was relatively easy to get between North Africa and Europe, at least in the early Cretaceous. So maybe spinosaurids were moving back and forth between the two, and that's how we ended up with this Vai Bonaventrix Moroccan-like spinosaur, but in Spain. But unfortunately, it's pretty fragmentary. You know, there's no skull. We're missing a lot of the other key bones, so we don't know exactly where it is in the family tree. We can just say that it's semi-closely related to Spinosaurus. And if you want to see Vai Bonaventrix, Juan Cano Forner Paleontological Museum.
Oh, he's got a museum and a dinosaur.
Yeah, so he found it. I guess he was an amateur paleontologist out there searching for bones, and then eventually he got his own museum, which is pretty cool.
That is cool.
There's very little information online about that museum, though, so I have no idea if they even have a public display.
Speaking of public displays, though, in Savannah, Georgia, Dave Trexler and team from Two Medicine Dinosaur Center are working on building a 135-foot-long Amphicelius fragilimus dinosaur for the Plant Riverside District Entertainment Complex. It's going to go in the hall and lobby of the original 1912 Georgia Power Plant building. So it will be the only replica of Amphicelius. And the dinosaur is being made of 230 bones dipped in chrome. It will be animatronic and able to move its neck 12 feet up and down, which is a lot.
Yeah.
The reason it's the only replica, potentially, is it was named in 1878 based on a vertebra that was almost 5 feet tall, and that was shipped on a freight train to Philadelphia and described and sketched by Edward Cope. So it's a Bone Wars dinosaur. And then when he died, that vertebra was supposedly sent with the rest of his collection to the American Museum of Natural History and cataloged as FR5777. But that vertebra is now missing.
Mm-hmm.
And more than 20 years later, after it was shipped there, Henry Osborne and Charles Took were analyzing Cope's collection and they couldn't find it. There's a lot of debate over whether this is a valid genus. Some think that it's a Diplodocus. And in 2018, Kenneth Carpenter, who spent many years studying Amphicelius, classified it as a new genus, Marapunisaurus, and reclassified it from Diplodocidae to Rebaccosauridae, and based the description of this dinosaur on Limaisaurus instead of Diplodocus, and estimated that it was actually not about 130 feet long, it was 102 feet or 31 meters long. Actually, instead of over 200 feet or 60 meters long, because originally it was thought to be this huge dinosaur. I mean, it's still big, but not as big.
Because it was a really big vertebra.
Yes. But again, there's a lot of debate over this. So Plant Riverside District will have a naming contest for their Amphicelius, and then there will be a grand opening sometime in March or April.
Yeah, as soon as you started talking about Amphicelius fragilimus, I was like, didn't they rename that? And then, yeah, Marapunisaurus is the potential new name.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a while for that to catch on, though. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Konglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners. And you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now we're going to go on to our interview with Matt and Brian. We're joined this week by Matt Wadle, who's a vertebrate paleontologist studying especially sauropod dinosaurs. You might remember him when we talked to him back in episode 161 about some sauropods. And he also studies the evolution of pneumatic bones in dinosaurs and birds. And he is an associate professor of anatomy at Western University in health sciences. He also co-founded the website Sauropod Vertebra Picture of the Week, also known as SVPOW, that you might be familiar with. And we're also joined by Brian Eng, who's a paleo artist. He's illustrated many of the recent dinosaur finds, including Aquilops, Dinamoterra, and Invictarx, just to name a few. He also makes puppets, movies, and music. You can follow him on Patreon at Historian Himself, or on Twitter, YouTube, or his website. And we also interviewed him back in episode 235 about some of his other stuff.
Hello, hello.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having
Thanks for having us.
So if you're wondering why we have Brian and Matt on at the same time, it's because they both recently found a new dinosaur bone together, and it's been hitting the presses. We actually had some people on Discord asking us about this, and I got to say, well, we're going to talk to them really soon.
Whoa.
Yeah. The buzz is going.
Good. That's good to hear.
Excellent.
So can you tell us a little bit about this latest discovery?
Why don't you go ahead, Matt?
I'll lay a little bit of the background, and then I'll let Brian take over when we get to the big find itself. For the past few years, since 2015, we've been working in the Salt Wash member of the Morrison Formation in Utah. Lots of people know the Morrison. It's a big late Jurassic formation that has lots of famous dinosaurs like Allosaurus, Stegosaurus, Patasaurus, Camarasaurus. Almost all of those are best known from big quarries in the upper part of the Morrison called the Brushy Basin. And we've been working down in the lower part of the Morrison because we want to understand how that ecosystem sort of got assembled. So we've been down in the salt wash several million years earlier. There have not been a huge number of dinosaur sites, dinosaur quarries from the salt wash. So we've been out there hunting and we've been finding some things. We hadn't made a big splash about our finds until we found something pretty special when we were out there last May.
So yeah, we've been going back multiple years in a row and just kind of seeing all of what we can find, because we've been finding a diversity of things, but it's in this really intensely hard sandstone from these ancient river channels. And as we've been exploring these sites, we've been getting really excited about the stuff that we've been finding, but it's a lot of it is would be extremely difficult to excavate because the stone it is in is crazy hard and it's in really remote areas. So basically we've been kind of going back, documenting our finds, filming a lot with the plan of putting out a documentary series, which we just uploaded the first part of to YouTube called Jurassic Reimagined, with kind of the goal of creating an awareness or sort of bringing attention back to the Morrison Formation, because it's actually really poorly understood. And there's still a lot of confusion and debate about how, like, where these animals came from, what the environment was like, how they evolved, what the diversity was in different times and places of the Morrison. So we've been going to this area and cataloging this unique ecology in the saltwash member. And then on a really short trip this year in May, which almost didn't happen, like the only three of us were able to get out there. It was me, Matt Wadle, and Tut Tran. Shout out to Tut. All of our lives conspired to make this trip almost not happen. It got kept getting trimmed down. We didn't have enough time and funding. The weather was bad. And then on the last day of this trip that only ended up being 3 days, we were going down this craggy wash and I doubled back to tell Matt about like some little fleck of bone I found in one of these sandstone walls. And then I just stopped dead in my tracks because I saw something and then I didn't believe the thing I saw. Matt at the time was looking at a lump of stuff in a gravel layer that we're pretty sure is a coprolite. It looks like a turd made out of rock. And he was checking that out when he hears me like, dude, you got to come down here and see this. So then I took a step back because what I was seeing was really soft, powdery paleosol, so ancient fossil soil, with a huge crumbling limb bone just kind of like crumbling out of it. And the outline was mostly obscured by the erosion and the fact that the edges of this thing were breaking up as they were weathering out, such that it looked like it was like camouflaged. It's like that feeling of seeing a camouflaged animal that's really exquisitely camouflaged and your eye and brain kind of complete the outline and you're like, no, there's no way that, you know, frog mouth or that gecko could like blend in that well and still, but then you see the outline. It was that kind of a sensation, but it was this huge bone that was bigger than me. And so I moved around and kind of posted up on one of these sandstone rock ledges nearby and was like, hey Matt, continue up from where you are, up this rise and tell me what you see. And so I captured this moment on film where Matt is going through this gulch and he's like, is this what you found? And I'm like, is what I found? And he picks up a chunk of bone off the ground that's like two phone books stuck together, but of solid cortical bone. So the hard bone on the edge of a limb bone. And I'm like, no, I didn't see that, dude. And so he's standing there holding this lump of bone. He's like, all right, well, I'll just put this back down. Where was it? And he walks up this ridge. And then you'll see his reaction in part two of Jurassic Reimagined. But we captured an extremely genuine reaction to a paleontologist who's been studying sauropod dinosaurs for, what, close to 20 years now, Matt?
Yeah, it's about right.
We captured his reaction to by far the largest bone that any of us had ever seen in the field, including our collaborator, Dr. John Foster, who's been working in the Morrison for 28 years. And within basically 5 seconds of seeing this thing, Matt had a couple of ideas of what it might be.
So most of the bones that we find out there, we find in this hard sandstone, like Brian mentioned, and usually they're stained very dark colors because of the minerals that have leached into them from the water moving through the rock. So a lot of times the bones we're looking at are purple or red or blue, and they show up really well against this white sandstone. And so you can see them sometimes from a long ways away. There's a tauropod femur that we found a few years ago that I spotted while having lunch under a tree that was probably, I don't know, 50 meters away from where we were. It was just like a dark line in the rock. But this thing, where it had weathered out, the soil was kind of like pale brownish gray, and the bone was almost the same color. So, Brian, I don't know, you must have almost, how close did you get before you saw it?
My right foot was 6 inches away from it. Almost. If my pace had been a little different, I would have crunched into it. I would have crunched into the proximal end of this thing.
Yeah, so I walked up and I saw, as Brian said, I found this other chunk of bone along the way. That's kind of how things go sometimes out there. You hit these rich areas. But I walked up the hill and there's this thing, and the proximal end that was sticking out, when we got it uncovered and measured it, it was about 2 feet wide. I don't think the full 2 feet of width was showing, but probably like a foot and a half.
Wow.
And we could see the grain of the bone going in. I don't remember if we could see the distal end right away, but it was clearly not a vertebra, clearly a limb bone, and clearly something really large. And just based on the size, the only things that could have been were a humerus or a femur. And just on the size, because the femora are usually bigger than the humeri, the thigh bones are bigger than the upper arm bones, I said, oh, wow, I think it's got to be a femur. And then I kind of checked myself and looked at the outline, because I've been obsessed with brachiosaurs since about 1997, when I started working on what would become Saura Poseidon. And when we described Saura Poseidon in 2000, we thought it was a brachiosaur. Now it turns out it's probably more closely related to titanosaurs. But I spent a lot of time looking at brachiosaurs, and their upper arm bones have an extremely distinctive rounded profile that nothing else looks like. And this had that profile. And I didn't even want to say it. I didn't want to hope that that was true. I was like, or maybe it could be a humerus or something like Brachiosaurus. And then Tut and Brian and I got our tools and sat down and started kind of clearing off around this thing, found the distal end and uncovered that, measured it. It was a little over 2 meters. So at that point, it was like, well, this is either a femur of like a really big apatosaur, or if it's a humerus, it has to be Brachiosaurus. The only humeri of anything in the world that are 2 meters long are brachiosaur humeri. Patagotitan, the dang near Argentinosaurus size thing from Argentina, its humerus is only about like 1.75 meters long. So brachiosaur humeri are in another league entirely. We kind of cleared off the proximal end and confirmed that it was thin front to back. Femora are really round. They've got that big round ball to fit into the hip socket. And humeri are kind of narrow at the top. When we saw that thing was narrow at the top, it's like, well, it's got to be a humerus. That's a brachiosaur humerus. And that's exciting. But at the same time that it was exciting, it was also like, oh, man, now we've got this thing is halfway down the slope of this gulch that's out in the middle of nowhere over very rough ground, with the nearest road being kind of an unmaintained Jeep trail that's a decent distance away. And it didn't look like it was in a very safe place. Like, it looked like maybe, you know, a couple of good hard rains and it would be gone. So we thought, hey, this is fantastic. We found this gigantic bone, this amazing find, but it's in a precarious position. It's vulnerable to erosion. We need to get it out, and we probably need to get it out this year.
Oof. So with just the three of you, did you guys take on that endeavor yourselves, or did you call in more people?
We needed John Foster, because we were actually there. We've been collaborating with John on this Morrison project under his permit.
Yeah, the desert habitat that it was found on is like beautiful, untouched, pristine Utah desert. There's rare plants out there. There's cryptobiotic crust growing on the soils. So we couldn't take motor vehicles out to it, and we had to devise a way to get it out that would be both safe and also not damaging to the environment. I would be really surprised if that wasn't the year that it was exposed. Like, if it wasn't exposed by one of those rains that hit us, like, we got rain on the day before, and then, like, you know, earlier in the spring and in the winter, it rains in Utah. And I would be willing to bet that it was exposed that year, and it would have been severely damaged if the coming winter had been allowed to rain on it. And then there's a freeze-thaw cycle. And bones are especially vulnerable to that because they're porous. They absorb water. That water freezes inside them, expands and destroys them. Because a lot of people don't realize it. Brachiosaurus is only known, up until this point, it was only known from 10 highly incomplete specimens. And only three humeri, upper arm bones, were known for Brachiosaurus. So this would be the fourth, and we ended up, those other chunks Matt found ended up being parts of the other humerus. So we found the fourth and a fragmentary fifth humerus for Brachiosaurus, which is also the 11th specimen total of Brachiosaurus. It really became this very complicated team effort where we assembled a team. Kind of all of us had a different sense of what would work and what didn't work, which was kind of cool because John had this, what I thought was a totally crazy idea. He's like, you know, we might be able to get this out with horses. And I kind of think that his daughter, who loves horses, planted that idea in his head. She went out there with us and helped us dig up one of these other chunks we found in the gulch near where Matt found that other chunk of bone. And I think Ruby planted this idea that, like, you know, horses are like the answer to everything in this 8-year-old girl's world. And I'm like, I'm really nervous because I'm like, oh, John, really? Like, we're going to go on the suggestion of your 8-year-old who is, I would dare say, a little bit biased in favor of horses. But then again, we know John has a lot of experience with this kind of stuff. He used to manage the Museum of Western Colorado Dinosaur Journey Museum, where they dig at the Mygant Moore Quarry all the time, and they've pulled some massive, massive Apatosaurus bones out of there. So we're like, all right, dude, well, I feel that we need something to put it on that can withstand this desert terrain. So I got a hold of a heavy-duty farm wagon, like one of these wagons people haul around, like wood and cement and stuff in. And I'm like, well, okay, maybe we can use a boat winch or something to like pull this through the rugged parts. And then, you know, Matt Wadle came through with a good sense of, okay, what are we going to need to really make this jacket strong? Thanks in large part to Matt, we showed up with a bunch of extra plaster, burlap, and wood. I'm pretty sure almost all of which got used.
Yeah, we had not a lot left over.
Yeah, basically every single piece of equipment and person we brought got used to their fullest potential. I also have to shout out my buddies, Casey Cordes and Mallory Neiman. They showed up. Mallory helped document the whole thing. And Casey is a pretty experienced rock climber and mountaineer and rigged these elaborate rope and nylon webbing systems to help us with the jacket flip and also with like navigating the wagon laden with over 1,000 pounds of fossil and plaster. He helped us rig these systems by which we were able to use a boat winch to pull this thing up out of this like amphitheater of rock. So it was this overall just a very multi-step, complex, abstract, yet also very traditional Morrison dinosaur extraction. And we documented the whole thing, which will be, that'll be featured in the third installment of our documentary Jurassic Reimagined. So we got the whole process on tape, and we found actually some other interesting discoveries along the way, which will also be incorporated into the upcoming installments of the documentary.
Awesome. How much did the bone weigh while you were trying to get it out?
So John weighed it on a truck scale when he got it back to Vernal, and the bone in the jacket, because we left some of the matrix around the bone to protect it. Mm-hmm. It's not like the movies where you clear off the, you know, skeleton right down to the bare bone. You try to leave some rock around there to hold the bone together and protect it, and then put the plaster around that. So the jacket in total weighed 1,020 pounds.
Oof.
And the wagon probably weighed right around 100, I'm guessing.
It was probably a bit heavier when we were moving it because the plaster was freshly cured. So it was still damp.
Oh, yeah.
So there's probably 50 plus pounds of water soaked into the burlap and plaster that had recently hardened up.
Yeah. I was going to say that thing ate so much plaster. So Brian has experience mixing plaster because he molds and casts things as an artist. And as we were mixing plaster out there, you know, in the first few batches, it rapidly became clear that Brian had a better sense for how that plaster was going to mix up. I don't know if it was the dry air or what, but that plaster set faster than any other plaster I've ever seen in my life. And so for a lot of the jacketing process, I think we had like three different buckets, and Brian would be mixing plaster in one, and we would be putting the burlap in it and putting it on the jacket. And then another one would be drying. And then the third bucket would be dry enough because after you do a batch of plaster, you got to knock out the chunks, or those pieces of plaster that are still setting will set off the chemical reaction in the plaster you're trying to mix. So we just had like these three buckets going in rotation. I've never seen anybody mix as much plaster as quickly as Brian did while we were jacketing.
So we're mixing all this plaster, but we also have to, we kind of jumped ahead in the story because we got excited about the actual extraction. It should be emphasized that a key part of the team that showed up due to John Foster looking for horses is they found this family, a family from Naples, Utah, named the Bartletts. Wes and Risha are the mom and dad, and they came through with four kids, two giant Clydesdale horses, and they all worked like around the bone to uncover it and to help us mix plaster and jacket it. And then while we were working on excavating and jacketing the large bone, the kids, so Rebecca Hunt Foster and John Foster's daughter, Ruby, who has been out in the field with us a bunch, and who's actually like a legitimately skilled young paleontologist. How old is Ruby 10 now?
I think she turns 10 this year. I think she was 9 at the time.
So this 9-year-old skilled paleontologist was showing the other kids how to jacket, because they on their own, just uncovering, look, dusting through the sediment around the bone, these kids found several other chunks of bone on their own, which they then basically took the initiative of jacketing and flipping and successfully excavating without really any significant adult supervision, which is really awesome. And then, you know, once we got clear of that, it became this complicated technical puzzle of like, all right, how do we get it down? We can't get it up out of the gulch right away because the wall behind it, it was right by the wall of the gulch, and it's really steep and craggy and crumbly and dangerous. It would be too heavy to lift straight out or hoist straight out. So we had to get it down into a gulch, take it a ways down the sandy wash at the bottom of the gulch to this stone amphitheater that was still quite steep and uneven, but manageably so. And then we had to get it from there up onto this ridge line. And then Clydesdale horses that these people brought, Molly and Darla, the Clydesdale horses, would pull this thing all the way to where we could load it on a trailer. And once we got it on this wagon, though, the Clydesdales would just walk with it. Like, there was nothing behind them. It was insane.
Yeah. The Clydesdales were phenomenal. They were each, I think Wes told me, they each weighed 1,800 pounds. And they're tall enough that when I stood right next to them, my eye line was at their shoulder. Like, I had to get up on tippy toes to peer over their shoulders. So it was really, really satisfying as someone who works on giant animals and spends a lot of time thinking about giant animals to use a couple of giant animals to pull a piece of another giant animal out of the field.
That's awesome. But compared to a Clydesdale, a Brachiosaurus is kind of on another level still.
A little bit.
Seven levels later. Way other levels.
So how long did that process of digging it out take?
So let's see. We all gathered together out there on a Friday. Saturday, we got it uncovered and just got it mostly top jacketed. And it went slower than we thought because it was so big and it ate so much plaster. So we'd hoped to get it. So the way we get a jacket on something in the field is you uncover it, you put on what's called a top jacket, and then you have to sort of dig. You kind of have to put it on a pedestal. You have to sort of make it look like a mushroom in cross section, kind of undercut it and put on more plaster because you want the plaster to grip around it as much as you can. Otherwise, when you go to flip it, if you don't have that grip of plaster around sort of towards the mushroom stem, then the plaster can just come off or the thing can just crumble. Mm. So we had to put on a top jacket, and then we had to pedestal it and put on more plaster wrapping around the edges and underneath. John and Rebecca even tunneled under the middle of it and wrapped some plaster around the middle. Then we had to flip it. We thought we'd get to the flip on Saturday. We didn't get to the flip until Sunday, got the back jacket on. And then I think we started moving it out of the quarry
Sunday afternoon,
maybe something like 3 p.m. And we got it out to the Jeep trail at right around sunset. Like, all our pictures then is gorgeous sunset light, like lighting up the desert, and it looks phenomenal. And then we had to get it down the road to the trailer. We didn't get it onto the trailer until it was well dark. And we were like pulling up vehicles and turning on headlights to have enough light to see what we were doing. Everything that we could use the horses for went so much faster and so much more smoothly than we thought it would. And everything that we couldn't use the horses for was like, what are we going to do here? Because we tried to move this thing and it was just, it was like it was fixed to the earth. It did not want to budge.
And they liked pulling things.
Did they like pulling things.
One of the things I got on film is the very last stage of this journey. We had, once we got to kind of a really rugged dirt road where we couldn't even get our trailer to. And there's some downhill stretches. And we couldn't have the wagon behind the horses on the downhill because it would roll into them and hurt them. Mm-hmm. So
you got to tell them about the thing that Wes calls a sled.
Yeah. So they've loaded it onto this thing that farm folk call a sled, but it's really not a sled. It's two 6-inch steel I-beams. So imagine
four. I think it was a full four sided frame with 2x8s bolted on top. And then the only concession to streamlining is that at the front, there was like a 4-inch round steel pipe. That was horizontal to help it roll over things. So Wes, it weighed 500 pounds and Wes would get this thing in and out of the trailer by himself.
Oh my God.
And our running joke was, you can call this a sled, but it's only a sled to Clydesdales. To any human, this is a building foundation.
Yeah. To any. Yeah. It was like a chunk of a dock. Like imagine building a dock out of steel, like you're going to moor ships to it, but it's, you know, I don't know, 5 feet by 5 feet. Meter and a half by a meter and a half, just this platform. And it just sits on the gravel and rocks of the dirt road. And then we load onto this 500-pound, not a sled. We load 1,050 pounds of dinosaur bone and plaster and burlap.
Plus nearly 100 pounds for the car hood.
Oh, yeah. We used the car hood to slide it from the wagon onto the sled, the not a sled.
Who had an extra car hood laying around?
John Foster. Everybody showed up with something. Matt showed up with some. Among the random pieces of lumber that Matt just instinctually felt like we needed was a round piece of wood. And Yara, paleontologist Yara Haridi, was with us, and she is Egyptian. And she saw us struggling to move this massive chunk of rock. And she's like, hey, you know, you could use that wood as a roller. Kind of like, you know, Egyptian style. So like, oh, that's really smart. And so we did. We moved it Pharaoh style, rolled it from again on these round pieces of wood onto this not a sled. And then the horses proceeded to two horses, 1,800 pounds apiece, strapped, chained with their, you know, halters and all their gear that keeps them safe and comfy while they pull things, to this massive load of friction on a really rocky dirt road. And then they said, all right. And Wes and his son Thane ran behind this thing with the reins of the horses while the horses galloped this monstrosity of friction across the dirt road. You could hear, and you'll see this in part 3 of Jurassic Reimagined, you can hear rocks being ripped apart by the steel beams on the bottom of this non-sled.
Yeah, that road was noticeably smoother after the sled went by, because we had to drive back out the next day to clean up the quarry, you know, fill in the hole, and we don't want to just leave these ugly holes all over creation. And there were rocks on that road that I've been having to steer around that just didn't exist anymore because they've been crushed into powder by the sled. And the noise that this thing made was insane. It sounds like machine gears grinding forever.
Like if there was a robotic demon that chewed up rocks for a living, that's the sound design that you would want. You'd want to get some Clydesdales and you'd want to load a Brachiosaur humerus on a sled and record it ripping through a rocky, dusty dirt road in Utah. And as they were pulling this thing, we had to take breaks, but I think it was in large part because all of us humans running after it were getting out of breath in the high altitude. And I kid you not, we would stop for a breather. And I was running alongside filming. And I'm watching these horses, just massive rib cages with just completely wrapped in huge latissimus dorsi muscles. Like you could see the massive muscles flexing these rib cages as these horses would breathe. And we would be catching our breath. And before us humans had caught our breath, one or the other of the horses would kind of look backwards. And Wes would catch that and, well, they're ready to go. The horses were like telling us, like, come on, guys, let's do this.
Let's get it done.
Yeah. And I asked Wes on camera, do they like doing this? They like pulling things? He's like, yeah, they like to pull. It was like one of the most like awe-inspiring natural history moments I've ever experienced. Like remove the Brachiosaurus from, like just load that much rock and see an animal do this thing that I literally thought was 1,000% impossible. Add in with the fact that the one bone these horses are pulling had probably a horse's mass of muscle attached to it alone.
Yeah.
And it's, my mind has been changed forever. I've been deeply, deeply humbled by the whole experience. And I'm really excited about finishing this documentary and putting it out in the world, just showing people like this, this is the planet you live on. It's legit bananas.
It makes you wonder, did brachiosaurs like to pull too?
Dude, I think
they like to push. We talked a lot about them pushing down trees while we were out there. And after seeing what the Clydesdales could do, we thought, yeah, they could probably push over a tree. And they probably did it all the time.
Just for fun.
So then when we're looking at this brachiosaur bone, where one of the things we filmed with Matt is him explaining what the deltopectoral crest is. For those that don't know, the deltopectoral crest is this ridge on pretty much every vertebrate's upper arm bone. You have it on your arm bone where your pectoralis muscle, so your chest muscle, goes in to your shoulder and attaches onto your upper arm bone, your humerus, while your deltoid muscle, basically your outer shoulder bump muscle, that wraps around onto that same front ridge. Both of those big muscles attach there to pull the arm forward and also to stabilize the arm when you do push-ups or walk on all fours like a brachiosaurus does. You have these big muscles attaching into that point. The deltopectoral crest on this brachiosaur humerus is one of the better preserved ones of all the brachiosaurus humerus.
But ours is in pretty good shape. And we're talking about a muscle ridge that's probably 5 or 6 inches wide and like foot and a half long, at least, if not 2 feet long.
Probably 10 inches tall. Like if the bone's laying down flat, like the muscle attachment point rises like a mountain range out of this humerus about, I would guess, 6 to 10 inches at its tallest point. So, one of the things Matt describes when we first flipped the bone, we were really elated because we got the deltopectoral crest was under it, where the way it was naturally buried. So when we flipped it, the bump of the deltopectoral crest was just under the sediment. And so we exposed the top of this deltopectoral crest. Matt got really excited being the anatomist on the crew. He's like, this is the deltopectoral crest. Mm-hmm. And he explains on camera what that is and why it's kind of significant to our biomechanical understanding of these animals. And the way he describes it in his interp is a muscle approximately the size of a cow attached to it. And yeah, that visual now, after seeing what these 1,800-pound Clydesdales were capable of doing, that concept just completely forever altered my perception of what biological systems are capable of.
That is crazy. Yeah, when like a single part of a dinosaur is larger than me, I start to lose a concept of what that means for strength.
Yeah, it's
one of the reasons I like being around the big animals like the Clydesdales is because, you know, if you go to a museum, you see the skeleton of a dinosaur that's like the size of a horse. And because dinosaurs get so much bigger, you know, Triceratops, Tyrannosaurus, the sauropods, the horse-sized ones by themselves don't look that impressive. Mm-hmm. But then you actually stand next to a horse and you run your hand over its shoulder and you feel these muscles. Some of the individual muscles in the horse's arm are bigger than your entire arm or like the size of your thigh. And you're like, wait, this is just an animal the size of a horse. And then you start thinking about an animal that's 20 feet tall at the shoulder and has a humerus that's 6.5 feet long. I can't help when I'm in museums trying to like visualize, what do the muscles look like? What do the blood vessels and nerves look like? What do the guts look like? And periodically getting to be next to really big living animals is a good way to kind of recalibrate my oh crap meter. Dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's crazy. So you guys hopeful that you might find some other bones?
So the jacket that we took out only has the humerus in it, which mm-hmm. they've now prepped out. They've removed all that clay stone from around it. And the humerus is now on display at the Utah Field House of Natural History. It's a state park museum in Vernal, Utah. So anybody can, they just unveiled the bone yesterday at the museum. So what we want to do is go back and look for more of these clay layers where there might be plants, there might be microfossils, there might be dinosaurs that are harder to bury. One of the things we wonder about with Brachiosaurus, is it possible that its rarity has to do with the fact that it's just like so massive? Like, you can't easily bury it. If there's a huge flash flood powerful enough to bury a whole brachiosaur, well, it's probably just going to like rip everything apart and transport it along with logs and stuff, just miles, and everything will get ripped apart and torn up and sent out to sea.
Yeah, finding stuff in the softer rock is exciting because we're still finding, like, we even added new big dinosaurs to our tally last summer, not just Brachiosaurus. There's a bit that you'll see in one of the upcoming Jurassic Reimagined videos where Brian found a beautiful stegosaur plate, and we've got evidence of Camarasaurus, Apatosaurus, Haplocanthosaurus. We've got some interesting bits of theropods. So we're kind of building up the big dinosaur fauna, and now we want to fill in the rest. We want to know about the small dinosaurs. We see essentially no small fossils in those massive sandstones. We only see pretty big stuff, say fist-sized on up to log-sized. And so we're missing a lot of the ecosystem. And if we can start finding these overbank deposits that are in the little bit more gentle setting, we can start finding these plants. Hopefully, I'd love to have a microfossil site where we could find like the little mammals and the lizards and turtles and crocs and things like that. Yeah. That'd be phenomenal.
Awesome. So you guys keep mentioning Jurassic Reimagined. When is one of these different parts coming out, and where are they coming to?
So part one just got released about a week ago on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/dinosaursreimagined. You can also catch some, I guess we could say, supplementary material or more in-depth scientific material on Matt's blog, SV Pow, Sauropod Vertebrae Picture of the Week. So that's svpow.com. He's been posting about some of the field IDs and how he makes those IDs. And we're almost finished with part two. I've got to handle some other commission work, so it may be a few weeks before that comes out. But I'm aiming for sometime late February, maybe early March, for part two coming out. And part three, it's a little bit harder to say. We're still sorting out some of the script details for part three. And I've generated a huge amount of art for parts one and two. Part three, I've generated some art for, but I'm so excited about the Morrison paleoecology and environment and kind of the changing views of it that my excitement makes me prone to overproducing art. So one of the things that we need to do is kind of home in on what are the main things we want to say and figure out, you know, where to invest my art making enthusiasm such that the project doesn't take 1,000 more centuries to come out.
Awesome. And then Matt, do you have anything else coming up that you want to plug?
All of the things that I'm working on right now are kind of more or less focused around the Jurassic. I worked in the early Cretaceous for a long time on dinosaurs like Sauropus Poseidon and Brontomerus and Aquilops. And really, in the last years, I've taken a hard pivot into the Jurassic. I've been working with John and others, a specimen of Haplocanthosaurus from Colorado. We described it in 2014, but we've been taking a closer look, and it's due for a redescription. It's got some interesting anatomical features. But I'm also excited about just doing more with the saltwash. So I came to paleontology as a comparative anatomist, and that's where my training was, and that's where most of my interest has been. And then going into the saltwash and like putting time in on the ground and walking across these exposures, seeing the ripples in the sand preserved in the rock for 150 million years, finding these fossil plants has kind of sparked an interest in me. And so I'm looking to broaden my own horizon scientifically to learn more about the plants, more about the ecosystem, the depositional environments, and help tell this story about, even in the Morrison Formation, this vast, famous thing that we think that we know, there's still so much work to be done. There's still so many mysteries to be unraveled. And I'm getting super excited about that.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you find out and then seeing it turn to life by Brian.
It is pretty great having a super skilled paleo artist for a best friend.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for joining us and talking about your new discovery. It's really awesome. And I'm really looking forward to seeing these Clydesdales running down the road with their quote unquote sled.
Thanks for having us. It's been great to get to tell the story. And just as while we were doing it, I was remembering little snippets that I'd forgotten about. I need to sit down and write sort of like a, I don't know, like a personal history of the dig so I don't lose all these little pieces.
Yeah, good plan. Thanks again, Brian and Matt, for the excellent interview. We had a chance to watch Jurassic Reimagined after recording the interview, and we both really enjoyed it. So if you're interested in checking that out, search for Jurassic Reimagined on YouTube, or you can go through their Patreon or through the show notes to the YouTube page and find it that way. We also have an extended version of the interview because every time we talk to Brian, we end up talking for over an hour, and this was no exception. So I think we ended up cutting out almost exactly half of it just to get it under 40 minutes long. So there's a lot more content with Brian and Matt for any of our patrons in the premium content feed. So definitely check that out too. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, How Languages Learned. We're very fortunate that we've been able to go on many trips together and see tons of dinosaur museums and sites all over the world. Over the years, we've been drawn to dinosaur museums that are pretty far off the beaten path and not typically where a lot of tourists end up.
Unless you're a dinosaur enthusiast. One of our favorites is the Kita Kyushu Museum of Natural History and Human History in Japan. They have a time traveling room, which reenacts the end of the world for the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous, complete with a gorgeous but haunting, extremely long-necked animatronic Mementosaurus. Knowing just a little bit of kanji made it so much easier for us to get to the museum and to even make it to that amazing time traveling room. It's kind of tucked away. Next time we go to Japan, we'll want to learn and practice our Japanese even more.
Yeah, and Rosetta Stone is a great way to brush up on languages before traveling. Their lessons are immersive, and it's designed to teach you to pick up new languages in a natural way. The lessons are short, about 10 minutes, so you can get them done at any time, even right after listening to a podcast, for example.
Wink, wink.
The best part is you can join now at rosettastone.com/dino, and you'll get a lifetime membership with access to 25 language courses at over 50% off. It's worth $399, but you can get it for just $179, and that's a reduction from last week. They just dropped it for our listeners even more. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Bite.
And now onto our dinosaur of the day, Jurevenator, which was a request from Ricardo via Patreon, so thanks. It was a Silurosaurian theropod that lived in the late Jurassic in what is now Bavaria, Germany, and it was a small bipedal carnivore. Only one juvenile specimen has been found, and it's about 29.5 inches or 75 centimeters long.
Oh, little guy.
Yeah. Adults may have grown another 6 inches.
Oh, boy.
Still little.
Yeah.
The skull is proportionately large, and Jurevenator had 3-pronged claws and serrated teeth. It didn't have many maxillary teeth. The holotype has 8. It also had a short humerus and a long fenestra in the skull. That's that opening. It may have been nocturnal. That's based on these scleral rings. It also may have eaten insects or small lizards. Gyrovinida is a rare find, and it's one of the most complete theropods described in Europe. It's the second non-avian theropod found in the region of Solnhofen, and this shows the diversity of predatory dinosaurs in the late Jurassic in southern Germany. A patch of Gyrovinida fossilized skin from the tail has scales and traces of what might be simple feathers. Xuxing said that the scales on the tail may mean that there was more variety in feathers of early feathered dinosaurs than in modern birds. He also thought that the scales could be a primitive trait and that Gyrovinida and other primitive feathered dinosaurs may have had more scales than modern birds. A follow-up study of Gyrovinida supported Xuxing's thoughts and found faint impressions of possibly primitive feathers were on the top of the tail and the hips. In 2010, a study by Helmut Tischlinger looked at the fossils in ultraviolet light and found more filament-like structures, similar to primitive feathers found on other compsognathids, such as Cynosauropteryx. They also found more patches of soft tissue on the snout and lower leg, and collagen fibers in the tail vertebrae. Gyrovinida is not completely covered by fluffy feathers, like baby chicks, and that may mean that the feathers appeared on some parts of the dinosaurs' bodies before others. The type species is Gyrovinida starkeyi, and it was described in 2006 by Ursula Golic and Louis Chiappi. The genus name comes from the Jura Mountains, where it was found, and Venator means hunter, as we talked about earlier in Garrett's news item. The species name is in honor of the Stark family, who owns the quarry where it was found. From 1989 to 1998, the Jura Museum Eichstätt at Eichstätt had a collecting program for a nearby quarry. Two volunteers, the brothers Klaus Dieter and Hans Joachim Weiss, found a slab with vertebrate remains. The team found the head of a small theropod, but it was too difficult to extract the fossils, so they did a CT scan to see if it made sense to dig the rest up. They only saw the neck and part of the lower back and decided not to continue, though the find was reported in 1999. And then in 2001, there was some publicity around the fossil, and it got a nickname, Borstei, which is a name often given to bristle-haired dogs, because it was thought to have bristly proto-feathers. In 2003, the director of the museum, Martina Kolbert-Ebert, decided to finish preparing the fossil. Pino Vogel took 700 hours to prepare the fossil, which had almost the whole articulated skeleton, the end of the tail's missing, as well as soft tissue, so turned out to be a worthwhile excavation.
Yeah, so I guess that CT scan couldn't quite see everything that was in there.
Yeah, and then the publicity helped. So originally, Gyrovinida was thought to be part of Compsognathidae and a close relative of Compsognathus. In 2012, Akeem Reisdorf and Michael Wuke described the taphonomy of Gyrovinida, and they think that the specimen may have floated for a short time and then sunk to the bottom of the basin after it died. It was found in a strange rotated position. The way the pelvis is rotated with aspect to the torso was odd. So there was probably some predation or scavenging of the carcass, but it still doesn't explain the weird rotation.
Not too much scavenging because still have a pretty good...
Right, all but the end of the tail.
Yeah.
Enough to just move it around in weird ways.
Just fish nipping at the end of the tail. Enough to turn it, yeah. And our fun fact comes courtesy of Matt Wadle. It's a list of the longest sauropod humeri, and according to him, therefore, the longest humeri of anything found to date. So up first, number one, the longest ever humerus, is from a Brachiosaurus. This one's from Potter Creek in Colorado, and it's 213 centimeters, or just barely short of 7 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty massive. It's also tied with a Giraffatitan, the SII specimen, in Tanzania, which is also 213 centimeters. Kind of makes sense because Brachiosaurus and Giraffatitan are famous for that giraffe-like posture with the longer front limbs, so it makes sense that they would have the longest humeri, which is their front leg, the top part of it, since they don't really have arms. Then in third place, or one and a half place, I don't know where to put it, is Brachiosaurus, but this one's the holotype from Colorado. It's probably 213 centimeters also, but only 203 centimeters is preserved. It's kind of missing the end. So yeah, not quite as big, but still very large. Up next is Giraffatitan, just kind of alternating Giraffatitan brachiosaurus, the XV3 specimen from Tanzania. That one's 210 centimeters or 6 foot 11. And then the new Utah brachiosaurus, which we talked about with Matt and Brian, which is 201 centimeters or 6 foot 7 inches. It's the next longest. Number six is the Ruyangosaurus, which is a titanosaur, the first titanosaur, and the first one that doesn't quite eclipse the 2 meter mark. This one's from China. It's probably about 190 centimeters in total, which would make it 6'3", same height as me. But only 135 centimeters of it is preserved. So there's a significant portion of it missing. But yeah, that means there were some really large titanosaurs going on in China, especially in the front legs.
Yeah.
The next longest, number seven, comes from Turiosaurus, which is an earlier sauropod from Spain. This one's 179 centimeters long, or 5'10". Then there's Notocolossus, the famous titanosaur from Argentina, which is 176 centimeters, or 5'9". Then we get our first African titanosaur. This one, Paralatitan, from Egypt, is 169 centimeters, 5'7". Patagotitan, which you may have seen at AM&H because it's on display there. It's pretty awesome. That one is just 167 and a half centimeters or 5'6".
Wow, I wouldn't have guessed that was on the lower end of this list.
Yeah, I mean, it is partly the posture because that one's more of a typical titanosaur sort of horizontal posture. It doesn't have that upright front leg move going on. So I'm sure that's a big part of it. Then there's Dreadnoughtus, the titanosaur from Argentina, coming in at a measly 160 centimeters or 5'3".
Measly.
Just like Sabrina.
I wouldn't describe myself as measly, thank you very much.
Maybe in the height category. And then the last one rounding up the top dozen is Footalongosaurus, the titanosaur from Argentina, which we were just talking about the other day. And that one comes in at 156 centimeters or 5'1". Does that one count as measly?
No, these are all very large. Good for them.
That's a good point, because apparently the average human humerus, it's kind of hard to say, is about 30 centimeters or 1 foot, and a long humerus would be about 1'2" or 35 centimeters. So compared to us, yes, these are all incredibly massive.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, that doesn't include the circumference of these things, several feet around, whereas our humerus is probably like, 3 inches, 4 inches?
Yeah. This is why sauropods are so great.
They are pretty cool. Not as good as ankylosaurs, though. Needs to be known.
No, they're better. They're bigger.
Are you saying bigger things are better?
In this particular instance with dinosaurs, yes.
I see. I'm going to quote you on that.
For dinosaurs. Don't cut off my quote.
I'll put an ellipsis.
And that wraps up this episode of Final Dino. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes and join our growing community at patreon.com/inodino. Thanks again, and until next time.